So this is April 22nd, 2012 in Redbridge.
Well, yes. Check if that's loud enough.
Well, it's a very small room, and it's not very many people here, but we can have it louder if you want. I practically don't even need a mic. Right? You probably all hear me without a mic. So yes, it's a very good point. This is the Krishna consciousness movement. We're supposed to be conscious of Krishna, but often we're conscious of everything but Krishna. By the way, why do we care about being conscious of Krishna? Let's take a step back even from that. I'm asking you. Why do we want to be conscious of Krishna?
Because we're told that that's the best way in which we can actually be happy.
You were just told that. Well, we're told all kinds of things. Why do you believe that? If you turn on your television or open a magazine, you'll be told all other kinds of ways you can be happy.
It's also said in the scriptures.
It says in the scriptures. Okay, well, that's a little bit better than the advertising agencies. You know, the advertising agencies are just trying to make a profit off of you, whereas the scriptures aren't going to make any profit off you. I don't think Vyasadeva is going to get a profit if you follow his advice. So then we're disinterested. Okay, so it said from the scriptures that the main way to be happy, and the scriptures, and the scriptures are the guide to life. They're like the instruction manual that comes along with the material world. We're okay now, it's fine. Can anyone explain the science of why thinking of Krishna is important? By the way, what time do we end?
6 o'clock.
Anyone tell me the science behind why thinking of Krishna makes you happy and gives you a successful life?
Well, it's God.
Because he's God.
Yes.
Okay. Why would thinking about God make you happy and give you a successful life? Okay, because he's happy. He's eternity, knowledge, and bliss. So if I think about something, someone that's happy, then I may become happy too. So other reasons. Why should we think about Krishna? Yes?
You're talking about science. And in the material sense, when we think of science, there's a hypothesis, a method, and a conclusion.
Yes?
So Guru Shastra and Sadhu explain how Krishna consciousness is a hypothesis, and then you carry out the method, and you come to the conclusion.
What's the hypothesis?
That if you practice devotional life, then you get Krishna prema.
Okay, what's the premises that lead up to that hypothesis? That's our conclusion. What are the premises?
That constitutional position is as a servant of Krishna.
Okay. Our constitutional position is as a servant of Krishna. More? I mean, why aren't we always conscious of Krishna? One problem may be that we're not convinced. Possible. Do you know what we tend to think about, right? We tend to think about whatever things, people, or activities we're convinced they're going to make us happy. So if we're not thinking about Krishna, we're probably not really fully convinced that thinking about Krishna is going to make us happy. What are the premises?
What does premise mean?
The whereases that lead to the therefores. Because this is true, because this is true, because this is true, therefore we do this. Because all humans are mortal and you're a human, therefore you're mortal. Therefore your conclusion is that you should live with your mortality in mind.
Well, we've tried to be happy in many other ways, and often we find that with those pursuits of so-called happiness, we find something very different. We find that we're very unhappy as a result. Mm. And we're told, again, we're told, and we have some experience perhaps, that things can be different, they can be eternal. And so, therefore, we're here. We're trying to...
Okay, so your first point is a negative one, that thinking about other things has not given us the happiness we seek. And then your positive one is after hearing from the scriptures, we may have some degree of practical experience that we get a certain kind of happiness when we think about Krishna that has a different quality. It has an eternal quality to it rather than a temporal quality. That's the ultimate evidence, by the way. Prachaksha bhagamam dharmam susukam kartam avyayam. The ultimate evidence for each of us is our own practical experience. But I still want to know what are the reasons.
You see other people experience it, so you want to experience that same.
Okay, of course that could be deceptive. I mean, I see a lot of people who appear to be happy by having money and something like that. Of course, really what's happening is they're thinking, I'm not really happy, but maybe somebody else is. Everyone's thinking somebody else is happy with it. But there's some appearance like that. I remember one time seeing a magazine cover of this man fishing somewhere, and it said, "The Good Life in Minnesota," which is a state in America. So we may think, oh, that person's happy.
No one is able to solve the four problems of life, as far as any science goes. And this promises to be a solution.
Why?
Because Krishna is, theoretically, he has all the qualities.
But why would thinking about him help me?
It's like connecting to a reservoir which has everything.
Okay.
So we expect it to come to us.
Okay, so your argument is that whatever else we do cannot solve. One reason it cannot make us happy is it can't solve our basic problems of birth, death, old age, and disease. And that because Krishna is a reservoir of everything we want, if we connect to him, we will get everything that we want. And we can connect to him by thinking about him. Okay, some other reasons.
There are. There seem to be many things. With
anybody who's sitting in the back in the chairs? You can't hear? Do we need this louder? Why should we think about Krishna? I mean, I'm about to give a class on how to think of Krishna, but if you don't know why we should think of Krishna, then the class will simply be mildly entertaining and you'll forget about it later. I mean, what is it if I teach you how to learn Spanish in a week? But if you don't want to learn Spanish, if you don't think it's important to learn Spanish, what use will there be to know how to do it? Does that make sense to everybody?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you frankly, a lot of the reason we're not thinking about Krishna is we don't think it's really important. We think it's important on some theoretical level. What is it that we think about? Consider for a moment what you've thought about today. What are the things you've thought about today? Oh, that's better. Whatever that was that just turned off. What was that was on?
Heater.
Oh, but then we'll all get cold. It's chilly in here.
Think about the weather.
We'll think about the weather. Okay? It's true. We definitely think about the weather. Why do we think about the weather?
So we can prepare for it
so we don't get sick. So we won't be too cold, or rarely in London, too hot. So we don't get too wet. So why do we think about the weather? Because we're in a material body, and it's very difficult to function and do anything we want if the body's not working, and if we don't think about the weather and dress for the weather, we've had experience that our bodies don't function properly. So because we're trying to protect our body, which we feel is the source of our security, which we feel is the source of our getting almost anything done in this world that we want to do, therefore we're very concerned about something which will directly affect our body, such as the weather. What else do we think about? Just consider, what have you thought about today?
Money.
Okay, why do we think about money? Same principle.
Security.
Security. In fact, they even call it that. If you know, they call it securities, right? And you get money? So people get money for security. They say the number one fear people have is that they're going to run out of money before they run out of life. So we feel if I have enough money, then I can get enough food, I can get a shelter, I can get clothing, I can have some freedom to go places, I can get entertainment, and so forth. Maybe even it'll help me get friends. Give me some status. And so give me even some position in a community. So therefore I think about money. Because I feel that money is important to getting what I need. It's important to fulfilling my desires. So what other things do we think about? What else have any of you thought about today?
Family.
Okay, so we think about family. Why do we think about family?
To have good relationships.
To have good relationships. Okay, so if we think about family, we'll get along with them, we'll have pleasant relationships, and this will give us what? Love, friendship, fun, again, security. We may think our family will take care of me. If I get sick, if I get injured, whatever, my family will take, if I'm poor, if I lose my money, if I go out in the weather without proper jacket and I get sick or I lose my money, then my family will take care of me. They'll be my security. Give me a sense of community, a sense of belonging, maybe a sense of meaning. So again, I'm thinking about something which I feel will give me satisfaction and fulfillment. What else do I think about during the day?
Cleanliness.
Okay, I mean, make sure that my clothes are clean. Like I'm staying in Iskon Soho, and there's certain days that the ladies can use the washing machine, and certain days that the men can use the washing machine, and certain times. So I have to think about that. I have to think about, okay, what day and what time can I do my washing? When can I do my washing in time to have my clothes clean and dry? So why do we think about cleanliness? For health?
We like people to be nearby.
We want other people to be close to us, right? So for friendship, for community, to have some acceptance in society, to be able to do some meaningful work also, I have to be clean, and for health. So again, these are things that I took for fulfilling my needs. So I think we can analyze that the things we think about during the day are those things and people and situations which we are convinced will bring us happiness in various forms. I mean, just straight out joy and play and fun and security and community and love or knowledge. You know, if we're going to school, we may think about our classes and our exams. We also probably think about the other people besides family that are involved in our life, our employers, our coworkers, or our employees, or the other people at school. We're thinking about how to please them. So if we understand that everything that we're looking for, Krishna is the reservoir of all pleasure, that everything we're looking for can be found in Krishna, then we will naturally want to think about Him. Unfortunately, materially speaking, we basically consider that God is irrelevant. Especially in modern society, it certainly appears that you can go through your whole life and never have anything to do with God. In fact, you know, most of the books and the TV shows and the movies, and there's not much to do with God. Very little. People are just going on in their lives, the magazines and so forth, without anything to do with God. So we're very much convinced that, you know, I can get everything that I need and everything that I want by things other than God, by my family, my friends, my work, my body, my money, my house. Now maybe we're also afraid that if I think about Krishna, I'll neglect all these other things. We might think, well, if I just think about Krishna, I might forget to take a bath. I might forget where I put my money. I might forget to be nice to my family, and then I won't have anything I want anymore. So yeah, I should think about Krishna, but mostly I have to think about these other things because that's what's practical. Of course, Krishna told Arjuna something very extraordinary. He said, "Mam anusmaram yujet cha." What does that mean?
Remember me and fight.
Krishna didn't say, stop your occupation. He said, remember me while you do your occupation. And what was the reason right before that that Krishna gave for remembering him? In 8:6.
Arjuna was refusing to fight. Arjuna was refusing to fight.
Yes, Arjuna was refusing to fight. But right before Krishna said, Mama Nusmam Yujacha in 8:7, what did he say in 8:8? The reason to think about Krishna. Give you a little hint. So the Gurukul children, they'd always remember this verse when we were eating really, really tasty prasadam, and they'd go, yum, yum, and then they'd say that verse. What's the 8th chapter of Bhagavad Gita about?
Attaining the Supreme.
Attaining the Supreme. About specifically... What part of life?
The end.
The end! Okay, so a lot of hints there about what 8:6 is about. It starts with yum, yum, and it's about the end, and it's about remembering Krishna. What's that verse? Yes, very good. Can you say it for everybody?
I don't know.
Yum, yum, vapi, swaram, bhavam, twacha, chante, kalevaram, tam, chame, vaiti, kanteya, sadatad, bhava, bhavita. So... Yum, yum, whatever, whatever. Anything you think about, that's what you get. So it's not just inconsequential. If I'm just thinking about the weather and money and my family and my friends and when I'm going to do the laundry, then what kind of birth am I going to take next? Another material body where I get to worry about my family and my friends and when to do the laundry. But if I think about Krishna, I don't get another material body. And the way the science works is that the mind is the source of the gross body. Our gross body fits on top of our mind. We actually produce our mind by our thoughts. The mind exists. It has substance. That's why sometimes people can see ghosts. They have some substance. The mind is not just... It's not that it doesn't exist. It has some existence. And the gross body fits over it. So I get a body according to my thoughts. Of course, I tend to think about what I do. So there's a relationship between karma, which means action, and our thoughts. If I think about Krishna, I no longer get a material body. And we see that great devotees who think about Krishna generally, not always, but generally, they also take good care of their families and their jobs, and they wash their clothes. It's not that if they're always thinking about Krishna, that they never take a bath, or they're not nice to their family members. Because when you think about Krishna, then you think about doing everything nicely for Krishna. Instead of thinking about my family or my money or the weather, because I'm concerned about my security and my happiness, I may be thinking about those things in terms of how can I serve Krishna. But I'm always thinking about Krishna. So I'd like some reasons now. Why should we think about Krishna? Now that we've discussed these things. So someone please tell me why we should think about Krishna.
Make a habit?
We should make a habit of thinking about Krishna, yes. But why?
At the time of death, it would be easier to...
Yes, actually, if you don't think about Krishna during your life, you're not going to think about Krishna at the time of death. The time of death, everything is falling apart. When everything falls apart, you would just naturally think about what's most important. And if you haven't made Krishna most important during your life, he's not going to be most important when everything's falling apart. Why else should we think about Krishna?
To help make our mind a friend.
To help make our mind a friend, yes. What about that he's just so nice to think about? No, he's our best friend. I think some of you were saying that before. He's a reservoir of all good qualities. And he's really going to give us everything that we want. We're not going to find security in securities. Is money really a security?
Yes and no.
Well, as long as the governments are stable and the economies are stable and you have no crisis in your life, then money can help you be secure. But you can't control any of those things. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that there was World War I and World War II in Europe. And it wasn't that long ago. There were still people walking around the planet who lived then. And you remember how in Germany after World War I, it took like a million marks to buy a loaf of bread. So what security was your money then? Or even, you know, even without a war, there can be economic problems and your money's just not worth anything anymore. Happens. Or you can lose your money, and so especially now that people's money is—they often have their money invested in this and that. You can your wealth. I know one friend in 2008. All of a sudden, he was worth only half as much, just because what he had invested in changed. Or there can be some crisis. You can have some sort of crisis in your life, and you've got to spend a lot of money, and all of a sudden, your money is gone. So it's not really a security, or somebody can steal your money. We always think, oh, that'll happen to somebody else, but you know, it might happen to me. Maybe today I'll be the somebody else. So it's not security. Somebody else can take it. It can all of a sudden be worthless. Right? My money is dependent very much on the government. I mean, even if you have wealth in things like land and houses and animals and gold and jewels, again, somebody could steal it. At times in World War II when the Nazis were conquering Europe and they would take over the houses of rich people. They would just throw them out of their house and take over the house and take all their beautiful paintings and their silver and etc. Correct? So that's not really a security. So Krishna's real security. He's always there. He's always full of everything we want. Family and friends, you know, are we guaranteed to have love and security from our family and friends? No. Even if they're the most wonderful family and friends, they might die before we do. It happens. And generally, our family and friends are not always the most wonderful. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're there for you, sometimes they're not there for you. Does anyone here have family and friends who are always there for them, no matter what? No. They might say that. I'm always here for you no matter what. But you know, if you test it sometime, you might find that it's not always the case. But Krishna is always there for us no matter what. So Krishna is the real source of our friendship and love. He's the real source of our security. He's the real source of our purity and vitality. Everything that we want for these other things that we think about. Well, when we talk about thinking of Krishna, we often refer to thinking about Krishna's name, form, qualities, and pastimes. Remembering Krishna's many, many names, remembering his form, which is one reason we have deity worship and we have pictures of Krishna up in our house, his wonderful qualities and what he does. But it's a little difficult for us. You know, I can remember what I did with my daughter because I remember being there with my daughter and doing something with her. I was there when things happened. I can remember my friends because I was with my friends and I did things with them. But it's kind of hard to remember Krishna's pastimes like that. Just like when Uddhava came to Vrindavan and he visited Nanda Maharaj and Mother Yasoda. And basically he was asking them, why are you just staying home and crying out of separation for Krishna, who was in Mathura? Maybe just get out of the house. Like if you meet somebody, if their friend's gone away or they've died, and they're just always lamenting, and you might say, why don't you just stop lamenting and get out sometimes? So Uddhava was saying like that. Well, Nanda Maharaj, instead of just staying home crying, why don't you go out? And he said, well, everywhere I go in Vrindavan, I see places where Krishna did things. And I remember, oh, Krishna danced on Kaliya here. Oh, Krishna swallowed the forest fire over here. Oh, Krishna lifted Govardhan Hill over here. So wherever I go, I again see Krishna. We might say, well, that's easy for Nanda Maharaj to remember Krishna because he was there when Krishna did these things and he was talking to Krishna face to face. But how do I remember Krishna? So what we would like to do, and we're not saying this is the only way, but what we're going to suggest is how we can use the very ordinary and common and constant things in our life to remind us of aspects of Krishna that we read about in the scriptures. Now, actually, all of us have seen Krishna, we've just forgotten. And in fact, Prabhupada says everyone has seen Krishna. It just depends on how contaminated they are, whether or not they recognize that they're seeing Krishna. So what happens as we make an effort to remember Krishna in this way? You know what happens? When we make a deliberate effort with our mind to use the things in our life to help us remember Krishna. Do you have an idea what happens? It first of all becomes easier, yes. At first it will be hard. If you try these things and you expect them to be immediately easy, and then you'll just give up. At first they will be difficult because we're habituated to think about everything else. But yes, it will become easier and easier. It will become more and more natural. And what else will happen?
Krishna will reciprocate.
Krishna will reciprocate. I mean, if somebody thinks about you and cares about you and loves you, don't you reciprocate? It's natural. So Krishna becomes very happy. Oh, they care about me. And just think, Krishna's giving us everything. He's providing everything for us. You know, if I do a lot for somebody, it's kind of painful if they never even think about me. I'm sure we've been in that kind of situation where you do a whole lot for somebody and they don't even acknowledge you. It's like you don't even exist. It's painful. And sometimes, you know, we'll just say, well, I'm not going to do anything for them anymore. But Krishna keeps doing things for us. He keeps taking care of us. He keeps providing for us. And he's very happy when we just even remember him, even just briefly. So what we're going to do here... It's hard to see. Okay, what we're going to do here is think about the different aspects of the material nature that we contact in our life and how they can remind us of Krishna. But what we're going to do, we're organizing this in a particular way. We're basing this upon the verse in the Bhagavad Gita, Bhumir Apanalo Vayu Kam Mano Buddhir Evacha, where Krishna says, earth, water, fire, ether, mind, intelligence, and ego, these comprise my separated material energies. There's another similar verse in the Brahma Samhita, Agnir Mahiga Ganamum Ambu Maru Jashascha Kalas Tatat Mamanasiti Jagat Trayani Yasmad Bhavanti Vibhavanti Vishanti Yamcha Govinda Madhipurusham Tam Maham Bhajami. Now, what the Shastra means by earth, water, fire, air. By earth, they mean anything that's solid. Water, anything that's liquid. Air, anything that's gaseous. And fire as the transforming element, and of course, everything existing in space. But we're going to look at this very specifically as earth, water, fire, air, and space. And for each thing, we're going to look at how the qualities of that aspect of the material nature remind us of Krishna's qualities. We're going to look at how that aspect of material nature reminds us of one of Krishna's opulences, one of the aspects of Krishna, and some particular pastimes of Krishna. So we're going to be looking at qualities, opulences, some aspect of Krishna, and Krishna's lila in relationship to each of these material elements. So we're going to start with gross things, with earth. Now again, earth can mean any solid, but we're going to refer basically to the earth planet and to soil. So the earth is very dependable. We were talking about securities. We don't think about, I mean, unless you live in some parts of the world, we're not thinking about, is the earth going to be solid under my feet today? We just assume I'm going to be able to walk around and the earth's going to be there. It's going to hold me up. It's going to hold up my house. It's going to hold up my car. So Krishna also is very dependable. It's one of his qualities of being dependable. He's so dependable that even if you're an atheist, if you follow the universal rules, Krishna won't punish you. That's what Rupa Goswami explains as dependable. And other than Krishna in this world, everyone is called a fallible soldier. So I always think of that as like little toy plastic soldiers. I had a cousin, whenever I would visit him, he always wanted to play with his soldiers. So I don't think I ever played with toy soldiers any other time, but when I visited him, I had to play soldiers. So you put out these little plastic or little metal soldiers, but they can't protect you. Or where were we? In Prague? I don't remember. Some European city. When they have this museum, and in front of the museum they have people dressed up like medieval soldiers. But they can't actually do anything. You know, they're just actors. So, but even a soldier in this world, they're fallible. They can get wounded, they can get killed. Whereas Krishna is dependable like the earth. And the earth not only is dependable, but the earth has a lot of power. As we can see in the time that the earth displays its nature as like volcanoes and earthquakes. So although generally you depend on the earth can also display the power to destroy or to build. And many of the islands of the world were built by volcanoes with great power. And Krishna also has great power. Bhutva bhutva praliyate. He's also going to destroy everything. He's building everything and destroying everything. And the earth is our foundation and support. So Krishna is also the foundation and the support of everything. Everything is resting on him. I mean, so just to walk on the street, just when we're walking on the earth, we can think, the earth is holding me up, it's my support, just like Krishna is my support. It's the origin and the resting place of all living beings. And practically everything that we use is made out of earth, and it's where earth goes to. And Krishna also says, on the beginning, middle, and end of all things. When you work with the earth, it's very satisfying, it's a very peaceful thing. To plant things in the earth and work with the soil. It's very therapeutic. And being with Krishna is also very peaceful and very satisfying. Very nourishing. We also talk about being grounded, being balanced. Someone who's a grounded person. They're a very stable person. So Krishna also puts us into balance and stabilizes us, that we're not brought on the waves of the modes of material nature. And all the shelters that we have, they're all made from earth or products of the earth. They're made from trees that grow from the earth or bricks that are simply heated earth, concrete which is made of aspects of the earth. Practically everything that gives us shelter. And Krishna is our real shelter. I mean, it's not that difficult. You just look at the walls and the ceiling and the floor of the room you're in and say, where has this come from? It's all come from the earth. And Krishna says that this earth is his energy. So he is the real shelter. The earth allows for a lot of creativity. You can take soil and mud and clay and make so many wonderful things. That not only is Krishna the creator, but we can all be little co-creators. We can see how wonderful and amazing Krishna is, that he takes protons, neutrons, and electrons, and by combining them in different ways in atoms and molecules, he creates all the incredible variety that we see in the earth. And the earth is the biggest thing that we are dealing with. I mean, you could say the sun is bigger, or the solar system is bigger, but as far as in our everyday experience, the biggest object is the earth. Practically bigger than our comprehension. And of course, Krishna is the biggest of the biggest. Then the earth is very attractive. It's very attracting. That's why we're not all floating in this room. We are all attracted to the earth. We're so accustomed to it We don't think much about it, but the earth is pulling us. There's this force of gravity, and Prabhupada says this gravity is actually Sankarshan, it's Lord Balaram. So Kulin Krishna means the all-attractive, and everyone is attracted to the earth. Of course, the earth is not only attracting with gravity, but also with magnetism. So the earth is also a huge magnet. Prahlad Maharaj says like that. He says that I'm attracted to Vishnu like iron is attracted to a magnet. So whenever we're thinking about the directions, you know, whenever we're walking someplace and we're thinking about the directions or we use a compass, we can think about, oh, this earth, which is Krishna's energy, it's so attractive. But actually Krishna is the source of all that attractiveness. Now, the opulence of Krishna that the earth reminds me of is that of wealth. Because practically speaking, almost anything that we consider to be wealth comes from the earth. Most things. Land, jewels, metals, oil, gas. So all those things come from the earth. One who has earth and the products of the earth is very wealthy. But of course, Krishna is the origin of all wealth. And whatever wealth we have, I mean, even the paper money in our wallet, the paper comes from trees that grow from the earth. And it's supposed to, anyway, represent gold, which is a metal that comes from the earth. Even the plastic, even our plastic credit cards, what do they come from? Plastic is made from oil, from petroleum. What's petroleum from? Petroleum's from plants, fossilized plants that come from the earth. So even our symbols of wealth, such as our plastic credit card and our paper, they're all coming from earth, which is one of Krishna's energies. So anything we consider wealth is actually Krishna. And of course, the earth can remind us of Krishna's abode. How wonderful Krishna's own land is. Chintamani prakrasadmashu kalpaviksha laksha avriteshu. Of course, in Krishna's abode, every atom of dust is a conscious, wish-fulfilling entity. The trees are desire trees. But this planet is a little dim, distorted reflection. So when we see the flowers, when we see the trees, the gardens, even the cities, Krishna also has his cities of Dwarka and Mathura, then we can remember, oh, Krishna also has his abode. He has homes and he has gardens and he has forests. And just seeing the normal thing, he also has vehicles, and I mean not these petroleum-driven cars, but he also has vehicles, chariots, right, and bullock carts. And whatever we see around us, we can be reminded of Krishna's abode. And then Krishna has some pastimes in relationship with the earth. So you think of some pastimes Krishna has in relationship with the earth?
He ate mud.
He ate mud. Yes, so Krishna ate dirt. And of course, when Mother Yasoda looked in his mouth, she saw the whole earth. And she saw all the planets. Some other pastime Krishna has in relationship with earth.
Lifting Govardhan Hill.
So that's Krishna as earth. Krishna as a mountain. Krishna's mountain incarnation. Krishna's incarnation as earth. Some others?
Krishna Balaram jumped off the mountain.
Oh, Krishna Balaram jumping off a mountain, yeah, to get away from Jarasandha. That child is not happy. What about Varaha lifting the earth? Okay, and then we also, Krishna has a form of earth in the form of the deity. Also, the deity is made from stone or metal or wood, which are all products of the earth, but they're actually incarnations of Krishna. Now, Krishna is fully present in the deity, just like he's fully present in Govardhan Hill. So, what my suggestion is that every day you take some aspect of earth to meditate on how this is Krishna, how it reminds you of Krishna. Okay, now we're going to go to water. So water is, although earth is very solid, water is very soft. You go swimming in water, you easily push it out of the way, but it's very powerful. So Krishna is also like that. He's very soft, but he's very powerful. When Krishna and Balaram fought with the wrestlers, Chanur and Mustika, They looked like just these delicate young teenage boys. They didn't look like big muscle guys, whereas Chanura and Mastika were these, they were mature men, and they were like these, you know, Mr. Universe's people. Which I've never seen why anybody finds that attractive. Kind of looks like a gorilla, but anyway, somebody must find it attractive. So little Krishna and Balaram, you know, there was these little delicate boys just on the verge of manhood. They weren't even fully grown up. They were very delicate and very soft. And yet they were so powerful that they could defeat these wrestlers without any problem. They could defeat even, you know, huge elephants and armies. So whenever we're using water, we can remember that although it's very soft, very pliable, still, it's very powerful. You can even eventually wear down stone. And of course, water is essential to our health and our purity. You can't have purity without water. You can't have purity of cooking. You have to wash your food. You can't have purity of your clothing, your body, anything without water. So Krishna is pavitram. He is the most pure. He said, just by thinking of Krishna, Oma pavitra pavitra vasavasta ham gatopi mayat smarat pundarikaksham yabayayantarad suchi. Shri Vishnu, Shri Vishnu, Shri Vishnu. One becomes purified within and without, no matter what. Whether having passed through all situations, whether being pious or impious, or even having passed through all situations, one who remembers the lotus-eyed Lord is purified within and without. So water is also like that. Whatever you've been through, if there's enough water, you'll be clean. And whenever we take a shower, we can think about, whenever we brush our teeth, whenever we wash our hands, whenever we're washing the food we're preparing, we can think about how Krishna is the supreme pure. And how we're talking about water is powerful enough to wear down stone. So in the same way, Krishna's name can wear down even our stone heart, even our stone-like bad habits. Water is very musical. If you listen to a river or stream flowing over rocks, it said when Krishna jumped in Kali's lake, he was splashing the water, which made music. So, of course, Krishna is also very musical. Prabhupada says the whole world is full of Krishna's singing. And water is very refreshing. So Krishna is also like that, very refreshing. If when you read the scriptures, you have kirtan, you take prasadam, anything to do with Krishna, you feel rejuvenated. And it's also very secretive. You go to the ocean and you just see this water, but underneath the water there's this whole world. You ever seen underwater photography? You know, you just look at the surface of the ocean or a lake or a river. It doesn't look like anything. But you go under and you see sometimes this whole amazing, colorful world. So in the same way, Krishna, what is it? Rajavidya, Rajaguhyam, very secret. That Krishna is hiding a whole secret world. And of course, water is the source of all taste. So we do a science experiment with children where you dry off your tongue and then you try to put like something, some sugar, some salt. You can't taste it. You have to have liquid on your tongue in order to taste. Krishna says, Rasoham apsukante, I am the taste of water. But actually, all tastes require liquid. All pleasure. If you think of rasa as pleasure, we have to have some wax in our ears and some mucus in our nose and some liquid in our eye and some moisture in our skin in order to get pleasure from any of these senses. If any of them become dried out, if your eyes, my eyes got dry once on an airplane where they have, it's very low moisture on an airplane, less than a desert. And it was so hard to see anything in it. It was just, my eye was paining so much from being dried. So water is the essence of pleasure, the essence of taste. In the same way, of course, Krishna is the reservoir of all pleasure. And water is also very graceful. We love to just watch moving water. People will travel long distances just to watch moving water, just to watch a waterfall or watch the waves or watch a stream. It's almost like the water is dancing. And Krishna, of course, is also very graceful in his movements. And everyone in the spiritual world, every step is just like a dance. So we're all dealing with water in our lives. When we deal with water, we can think of some of these qualities of Krishna. And we were talking about how water is essential for any sensory pleasure. You can't get any kind of taste or smell or sight or hearing or touch without some liquid. But water in general is very much associated with enjoyment. Where do people like to go for vacations?
Seaside.
Places with water or sometimes snow. But practically all the vacation places, almost all of them are associated with water. So Krishna also likes to play in the water. His whole existence is full of pleasure. He likes to play in the Jamuna and Radha, so many places, so many lakes and rivers. Even Krishna's city is in the middle of the ocean in Dwarka. So Krishna very much likes to play in the water. And we can think about what kind of pastimes does Krishna have in water? Kaliya. Okay, what others? Stealing the gopis' clothes in the Jamuna?
Yeah.
Every day he swims in the Jamuna. He swims in Radhakund. Radhakund, Shamakund. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu likes to go swimming in the Ganga. They play water sports. What about Vishnu lying on Seshanag in the causal ocean? Matsya avatar, swimming in the water. So how many times are we using water every day? For drinking, for washing, for cleaning. You know, when you throw your clothes in the washing machine, you don't have to just throw them in the washing machine and push the buttons. You can throw them in there and say, oh, this water is cleaning all of my clothes, just like Krishna is the ultimate purifying agent. All right, now we're going to go on to fire. And we're going to look at fire in two categories of qualities, heat and light. So first, the qualities of heat. So heat is invisible. So we talked about how water is very soft but very powerful. Heat is invisible but very powerful. So Krishna also is not directly visible in this world. Sutre Manigana Ivan said he's like the thread that's under the pearls. So if you have a pearl necklace, you don't see the thread, you only see the pearls. And how do you know the thread is there? Right, because the pearls are arranged there. So you can feel the heat, but you can't see it. Sometimes, of course, you can see ripples in the air. So in the same way, Krishna is obvious here by his actions, but he's not seen. And fire excites. You know how fire cooks. It excites the molecules in the food, and they start jumping. You know that if you boil water, if you put water on something hot, the molecules start jumping around and moving. And pretty soon they're jumping out of the pot into the air as steam. So in the same way, when you cook food, you're exciting all the molecules. I mean, we get also, you know, restless if it's very hot. So Krishna is also exciting everything. He's vitalizing everything. He's moving everything. He's energizing everything. And fire is exciting the molecules in the food. It's transforming the taste and the texture of the food. If you think of, say, you know, broccoli, you can eat it raw or you can eat it cooked, but the texture and the flavor changes. So in contact with Krishna, we change. We come to a state of purification. We come to a state of happiness. And fire both creates and destroys. You can create things with fire. You can create beautiful jewelry. You can create a nice preparation to eat. So many things are created with fire, with heat. But it also destroys. So Krishna is also creating and destroying everything. And we're digesting our food with the chemical fire, which Krishna even says, I am the fire of digestion. In fact, Krishna specifically says he's the heat and fire. So this power of digestion, eating is useless if you can't digest. You ever eaten something you couldn't digest properly? Horrible. So we cannot get nourished simply by eating. We also have to properly digest. So that is Krishna. And of course, we talk about how knowledge burns up ignorance. talk about a fire of knowledge that burns up ignorance. And warmth, when Krishna said he's the heat and fire, that warmth of fire, we associate warmth with life. A living being is warm. It's like we're warm-blooded creatures. You know whether or not someone's alive by whether or not they're warm. And Krishna, he's the life of all life. Whenever we're aware of the warmth in our own body or the bodies of others, the warmth in the room, we can remember how Krishna's the source of all life. And love also. We associate warmth with love. We talk about a warm embrace. And sometimes people give you a cold hug or a warm hug. Now, what do we mean? Is it actually like hot? No, but we use this sort of terminology. We very much associate warmth with caring, with life and with caring. And Krishna, who is all heat, he says, I am the heat. Krishna is the ultimate life and the ultimate love, the ultimate caring. And whenever we feel the caring of warmth, we can think how caring Krishna is. Now looking at the qualities of light, so Krishna also says he's the light of the sun. And light allows us to know things. Without light, we can't understand things very well. We get a lot of knowledge through our eyes, which are dependent on light, to know where things are, how things are situated. And light, of course, is used for ultimate knowledge, Gyanadipena Bhashvata, the light of knowledge. We have the word enlightenment. The Vedas often say, come out of the darkness, come into the light. So even ordinary light from the sun or from light bulbs can remind us of how ultimately Krishna lights up our consciousness, illumines our consciousness with knowledge. We also use lights for welcoming. The Aditi ceremony, we use lights as a welcoming ceremony. And even if some guests are coming to your house, you make sure the lights are on. You make sure, you know, like you turn on the lights or you open the shades to welcome them. So Krishna, who's the origin of all light, who says he is light, he is the most welcoming. He's always welcoming us to come into his association. We also associate lights with festivals. So most of the cultures of the world, they have some festivals that are associated with lights, just like we have Diwali, or there's Christmas, or, you know, at New Year's. Even secular festivals, people are setting off fireworks and lighting lights as a way of having festivity and enjoyment. And of course, Krishna is the source of all enjoyment. And we also think of a light-hearted person as being jolly, someone who's full of light. So Krishna is the most jolly and joyful. And light is the source of all food. Actually, whatever we're eating, we're really eating light. You all remember that from science? Did you learn that in your science class, that we're eating light? You didn't know that? Have you ever heard of photosynthesis? No, you will. So when you hear about photosynthesis, and who's this young man here who's very absorbed in his jacket? Have you heard about photosynthesis in school? So what's photosynthesis?
Like the plants absorb light and make their own food.
Yes, they turn sunlight into food. So the plants are getting the light, and they also, of course, use water and some minerals from the earth, although they can get the minerals from the water. You can do gardening with just water and sun. So the plants are turning the sunlight into food. And then everything ultimately eats plants. Even creatures that eat other creatures that eat plants, or they eat other creatures that eat other creatures that eat plants. And everything goes back to the green plants, which means that everybody is ultimately eating sunlight. That's why there are some yogis that can stop eating, because they get their food directly from the sunlight. So you can't do that if you're not a yogi. You either have to be a yogi or a plant to eat sunlight. But actually you have to eat it directly. But we're all actually eating sunlight. It's our nourishment. So it's Krishna who says he's a light. What's really nourishing us? It's Krishna. Krishna says, I'm the light of the sun. So the power to digest our food, and even the food itself, it's actually Krishna. Nice meditation next time you're eating. okay? And light is also very refreshing and rejuvenating and enlivening. And it reminds us of Krishna's opulence of beauty. There's no such thing as beauty without light. You can't see beauty without light. And light, of course, is the source of all colors, the ability to see form and all colors. So therefore, light can remind us that Krishna is the most beautiful, and remind us of Krishna's form, because you can't have form without vision. And Krishna's form is described as effulgent, as full of light. Also, his form is often described as glittering or reflective. It's described that his earrings are reflected off of his cheeks. So, you know, my skin doesn't reflect my jewelry, but Krishna's cheeks reflect his jewelry. It's described as brilliant, like light. And what are some of Krishna's pastimes related to light? Or heat? Fire. He swallowed fire twice. Two times Krishna swallowed a forest fire. One time by the bank of the Yamuna after sending Kali out of Vrindavan, and another time when the cows wandered away and got stuck in a fire. Anything else in relationship to fire? Because you have Krishna's devotee, Draupadi, who was born from a fire. We have Krishna's weapon, the Narayanajwara, which was very cold, which fought with the Shivajwara, which was very hot. Personification of fire and cold. Okay, now we're going to go on to air. So air is very, very subtle. I mean, none of us can see the air in this room. You can only see air when it moves something else. You can only see air by its effects. So similarly, we only see Krishna by his effects. We don't see his hand. We see the beautiful flowers that are as if they've been painted by an artist, but we don't see the artist painting them. And then, you know, we have air pressure. You all know that, right? So, you know, the air is pushing on our body. I think it's 14 or 15 pounds for every square inch on our body. That's a lot of pressure. But yet we don't feel it. We're not aware of it. So in the same way, Krishna is all around us, but we're often not aware of him. We go on as if he's not there. And air can move things that appear to be more substantial. Air appears to be not substantial at all, but it can move big, heavy, solid objects. So Krishna also, he appears very subtle and very fine, but he can affect gross things, although it doesn't seem like that should be the case. And air can carry things without mixing with them. So Krishna explains also that he's like that, that he's able to be in our heart and be aware of our desires and carry us with our desires from one body to the next without becoming contaminated by those desires, just like air carries a fragrance. Or, you know, whenever you smell a fragrance, you can think, oh, the air is carrying this smell. Just like Krishna can carry us with our desires from one body to the other. And air is our most essential bodily need. So you can have nice food and nice clothing and good friends and money in the bank and a good job, but if you don't have air, it's all useless. You know, if you went in a room with a good meal and all your friends around you and then it was hermetically sealed and all the air was gone, you wouldn't be able to enjoy anything. So recently when I was in Czech Republic, the devotees there were heating with a wood stove. It was a very small room, and we had a pretty big crowd. I'd say we had maybe 20, 25 people in that room for an evening program. We're having this blazing wood fire, and the walls were very, very thick. And the windows, it wasn't just double glazing. It was two windows with 1 foot of airspace between them as insulation. So when I woke up that next morning, I had such a terrible headache. And the person I was staying with, the people I was staying with, they said, oh, there was no oxygen in the room. When you're burning the fires, using up oxygen. And they said, having all these people in the room breathing and then having this wood fire going and the room was all sealed, they said, you didn't have any oxygen. They were telling me that they had the same problem sometimes. And that the next night when we had a program, we made sure we opened the windows for a while. So without air, without enough oxygen, it doesn't matter how nice everything is. You won't be able to function. So it's not that Krishna is just an add-on to our lives. Krishna is the most essential aspect of our lives. If we don't have Krishna, then whatever else we have will not satisfy us. Just like if we have everything but we don't have air. And our air is also responsible, of course, for digesting our food. You can't have fire without oxygen. So that's why we're breathing all the time. We're breathing so that the process of digestion can go on. And Krishna says, I mix with the air of life to digest the foodstuff. So Krishna's actually, when we're breathing in and breathing out, Krishna says that that is himself as the air of life. And then it's described by the Goswamis in describing the spiritual world, how the wind is the dance teacher of the trees and the plants. You've noticed that when the air blows over trees and plants, they appear to dance. And so it's like the wind is teaching the trees how to dance. So whenever we see plants fluttering in the wind, we can think about how Krishna always likes to dance. He dances with the cowherd boys, he dances with the gopis, he loves to dance. And one of the ways that we please Krishna also, of course, is by dancing. And the air forms patterns, especially in sand and in water. All the waves in large bodies of water is caused by the air, and the ripples in sand is caused by the air. It's a very beautiful artist. So Krishna also, the unseen artists. So Krishna also is the unseen artist, is creating everything in this world. This reminds me of Krishna's opulence of strength. You know, a windstorm can take a little tiny piece of wood and put it through a metal wall, a tornado or a hurricane. And of course, Krishna is the most strong. He says he's carrying the planets on his head. And he doesn't even feel them. Just like if you had a little mustard seed on your head, you wouldn't even know it was there. So strength without effort. Strength without even awareness of strength. And what are some of Krishna's pastimes or activities related to air? Trinavarta. Oh, very nice. Something Krishna is really famous for that involves air. Practically every picture of Krishna.
Flute.
He's playing his flute, which is a wind instrument. So when Krishna blows into his flute, that sound, it makes everything reverse their natural propensities. The rivers stop flowing, the stones melt. Everyone forgets themselves. And we have some idea in this world, famous musicians, people will go crazy over them. But not like Krishna's flute, so he's the best musician. And Krishna also breathes out the universes. Yakarinarna Vajalaya Bhattatisma Yoga Nidra Mananta Jagananda Sarama Kupa Adhara Shakti Mavalambya Paramaswamurti Yasaikinispati Tikala Matavalambya Jivanti Loma Vilaja Jagananda Nata Vishnur Mahansa Ihayasta Kala Visesho. So he breathes out. You know, when I breathe out, there's some little tiny microscopic universes, little cells and. When Krishna breathes out, he creates, his breathing creates the whole cosmos. And he breathes in and it's all disintegrated. He also, it says that his breathing is also the Vedas. That the Vedas are simply his breathing. So I have to make intelligible words with my breathing. I can't just breathe. I have to use my breath with my vocal cords. But Krishna, just breathing, it actually creates the whole Vedas. In fact, it's the sound of Krishna's flute entering into the ears of Brahma that comes out as Gayatri that expands into all the Vedas. Krishna also likes to fly through the air on the back of Garuda. He has his own private jet. He doesn't have to wait through security lines or worry about his luggage. And he just stands up on the back of Garuda and goes flying through the air wherever he likes to go. All right, what about space? This is going to be our last one. Went from gross to subtle. So space is the basis of everything in material reality. It's the first main material element, just like Krishna is the basis of everything. And it's really completely undetectable. I mean, it says in the Shastra you can detect space through sound. I'm not exactly sure how that works. But I see that we detect space by the boundaries, not by the space itself. I mean, how do I really know there's space in here? How do we sense that? It's very, very subtle. So Krishna is also undetectable by the material senses. And it defines everything. So I discovered that the one question any stranger can ask another stranger is, where do you live? It's quite interesting. The only reason I discovered that is because for a long time I didn't live anywhere. Before that, I never thought about it. But all of a sudden, when I had no question, no answer for the question, I became very aware how often people asked it. And people ask it to perfect strangers. I mean, you don't ask a stranger right off the bat, what do you do for a living? Are you married? How old are you? You know, what's your favorite color? What's your political party? Where do you live? Or sometimes it's, where are you from? So I thought a lot about that. Why do we ask that question? Because we want to place them. We can't make sense of people or anything unless it has a place. Where does it go in space? Without knowing where something goes in space, we can't figure out its relationship to anything else. And therefore, we can't define it. And it was quite interesting. Because I find that some people, when I answered, oh, I don't have a home, they would just leave it at that. And other people would keep persisting. And they'd say, no, where is your base? I said, I don't have any. Well, what do? I travel. Well, what do you do when you don't travel? Or where do you spend most of your time? I say, when? Where did I spend most of my time this week or this month? Or... And sometimes people would get so confused. I mean, seriously, probably 1 out of every 10 people, whether devotees or not devotees, they just couldn't get their head around the idea that here was someone they couldn't put in a particular physical location, that didn't belong in any particular location, that they had a very hard time defining me. So Krishna also, our relationship with Krishna is the main thing that defines us. Where do we stand with Krishna? What's our relationship with Krishna? That defines everything else. And space is generally out of our awareness. Of all of the elements, it's probably the most out of our awareness. Unless you're in a very cramped place. So Krishna also tends to be out of our awareness. And space, though, when you have a lot of it, it can be a real source of joy and exuberance. And that's another reason people like to go to the seaside. You know, all of a sudden there's all this, not just a river, but all of a sudden there's all this space. Looks like there's practically unlimited to the horizon, and there's a real sense of joy and freedom. And Prabhupada said the need of the soul is to have freedom. So space very much represents freedom. Any kind of space. You know, if I have space in my house, then I have the freedom to buy something else or to move other things around. Also had a funny experience with space, that my daughter-in-law's space bar on her keyboard got broken by one of her children. And she could no longer type an intelligible sentence. It was taking me a long time to decipher her sentences, and I realized that space allows us to make sense of things. To separate one thing from another and define things. That Krishna also is what allows us to make sense out of things. And then space reminds us of Krishna's opulence of renunciation, of freedom. Krishna is not obliged. We also have this opulence of freedom, of free will. We have independence. Actually, a person's not very attractive, no matter what other opulences they have, if they're very attached. It's only this opulence of renunciation that can bring actual attraction. And of course, the element of space, which can be understood by sound, reminds us of Krishna's name. So we've thought about Krishna's form, Krishna's abode, And space reminds us of Krishna's name. Krishna actually said he's any sound that travels through space. And sound can't exist without space. What is sound? Materially, what is sound? Something that's vibrating. Can you vibrate unless you have space? There has to be space to move in order to create a vibration, in order to create sound. Of course, Krishna's name is not just a vibration of something material. But space reminds us of Krishna's name and how Krishna incarnates in his name. Okay, any kinds of pastimes connected with space? Vamandev, who covered all of space in two steps. In Bali Marj, yes. Vamandev in Bali Marj. Some other pastime with space. Yes, so Krishna shows all of space inside of his mouth. Any others?
Kurmavata.
Okay, why?
Because he, the fish of the Matsyavata.
He was in the water.
He grew.
He kept filling up the space. Oh, that's lovely. So first he was just like in the palm of the king's hand, and then he was in a little bowl, and he very, very quickly grew to take up all of the space. Any other pastimes of Krishna have to do with space? Viratrupa, that was in all places in one place. And this is some of Krishna's mystic opulences with space. So there's a story that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu tells of how one time Lord Brahma went to see Krishna in Dwarka. He knocks on the door. The doorkeeper comes. Yes, who are you? I'm Lord Brahma. Comes back and he says, Krishna wants to know which Lord Brahma? Which Lord Brahma? What do you mean, which Lord Brahma? The four-headed Lord Brahma. You know, with the father of the four Kumaras, the head of the universe. Oh, okay, come in. And when Brahma comes in, what did he see? Many Brahmas. From many, many different universes, having up to 10 million heads. Don't ask me to draw a picture of that. And Brahma saw that he was the master of a very small universe. All right, now the point about space is it's described that each of those Brahmas, except ours, perceived Krishna as being within his universe and didn't see any of the other Brahmas. So how is it that Krishna was in one place, and yet each of the Brahmas thought that Krishna was within his universe? Krishna can obviously do some very interesting things with space. Another example is when Krishna is sitting in the middle of the cowherd boys, and there's many, many cowherd boys, thousands at least, and each cowherd boy is seeing that Krishna is facing him, not just looking at him, but actually facing him, like I'm facing this way, I can turn my head this way. But I can't look at all of you at once. And I can't face all of you at once. And Krishna, even the boys who were behind him, Krishna was facing all of them at once. So each cowherd boy thought, Krishna's looking at me. How does he do that with space? So obviously Krishna's experience of space is very different from ours. And of course, one of my favorite, one of the most mysterious verses in the Brahma Samhita, Ekopyasaurichaitam jagadandakoti yachchaktirasti jagadandachayayananta andantarasta paramanuchayantarastam. That within Krishna is all the universes. Well, we know that. Mother Yasoda saw that. And then Krishna is within every atom. Well, we know that too. Try to put those two things together. So within every atom there's Krishna, and within Krishna there's the universe. Can you do that? It happens to your brain. So Lord Brahma talked about this. He talked about how Mother Yasoda saw the universe, including Brahma, inside Krishna. He said, how am I talking to you outside? How am I standing here talking to you? Well, actually, I'm inside you. So obviously, Krishna's idea of space, you know, space that we experience is part of the material creation. So in the spiritual world, often it says that the spiritual world is beyond time and space. What about the pastime when Krishna takes Arjuna throughout the universe on his chariot? He traverses through all the planets and he goes through all the coverings of the universe. And of course Krishna flies, and Lord Vishnu flies throughout space on Garuda. So all of us are experiencing every day the earth, water, heat, light, air, and space. Now we have to make some effort, because it doesn't take us much effort to think about our money, or the money we wished was our money, the weather, our family, our friends. That doesn't take much effort, does it? We don't have to sit down and say, today I'm going to think about my money. We just do. Or today, now I'm going to think about my family. We just do think about our family. It just happens. Our mind just naturally goes to these topics, because that's where our attachment is. Because that's where we feel all of our needs and all of our desires are going to get met. So there will come a time when our mind will naturally go to Krishna if, and only if, we make a deliberate effort to practice that. It's not just going to fall on us one day. But a deliberate effort to think about Krishna, which will then finally attract us to Krishna, after which time we'll think about Krishna as naturally as we now think about what the weather's like and how much money we have. So that's what sadhana bhakti means. I mean, we can talk about sadhana bhakti. Oh, let's look at this. My mom is always on my mind. What a nice shirt for this class. So why for the little child are they always thinking about mommy? Because mommy's the source of everything, right? They say mother is the name for God for little children. Mommy's the one who feeds me. She's the one who cleans me. She's the one who comforts me. Right? It's a little baby. They can't see their mother. They'll cry. So we want to get to that point that we think of Krishna as naturally as a tiny baby thinks about their mother. Because really that's our relationship with Krishna. He's our mother, he's our father, he's everything. But unfortunately we've gotten out of practice. So we can easily do it. One does not need to first become a very advanced devotee and then you can think about Krishna. The only way you're going to become a very advanced devotee is by thinking about Krishna. We're not saying, okay, first perform Astanga Yoga and clean your mind and good luck performing Astanga Yoga in the Kali Yuga anyway. You know, I've met a few real yogis. Probably about five. Some. But good luck. To perform Astanga Yoga, first you have to be expert in Varnashram, then you have to be expert in Karma Yoga. So that's not what we're doing. We're not saying, first I'm going to become purified, then I'll think of Krishna. I can't think of Krishna because I'm not a pure devotee. The way we become a pure devotee is by thinking of Krishna. And it's a deliberate effort. Krishna calls it Abhyas Yoga. Abhyas means?
Practice,
and it literally means repetition. So repeatedly, over and over again. And don't get discouraged. If you go a day or two or three or four or ten and you haven't thought about Krishna, you can still start now. It doesn't matter whether you thought of Krishna at all in the last 5 million births. You can still start now. You don't have to say, well, it's too late. It's already 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It's already 6:10 in the afternoon. I haven't thought about Krishna yet today, so the whole day's a wash. I might as well not even try. You know, wherever you are, start thinking about Krishna now. And it's not that difficult. It really only takes a few moments to meditate on how can the elements of my ordinary surroundings, how can they remind me of Krishna? I mean, this little exercise I just did wasn't that hard. You know, it took a little thought, a little care, but it wasn't like it was something remarkably difficult. It's something that any of us can do with anything that we're relating to in our lives. How does this remind me of Krishna? How does this remind me of Krishna? And then we'll very quickly reach the perfection of self-realization. So it's already a little after six. Do we have time for questions or should we just stop?
Yeah.
Yes, for until how long?
Until 5:30.
final.
Any questions, comments? Yes.
Thank you for the amazing class. I just have one question about one thing you quoted from Srila Prabhupada. It was that the fact that the need, the soul has a need for freedom.
Yes, it's in the first canto.
Can you just comment a little bit on that?
What specifically is would you like to know more about?
In what context is Srila Prabhupada talking about?
He's talking about it in the context. Okay, we say a liberated soul. What does liberated mean? Free. A conditioned soul is not free. I'm not free. I'm stuck in this body. I may not like this body. Anybody here totally like the body they're in? But here I am. I mean, I can kill it. I can commit suicide and kill it. But that doesn't get me free. I just get put in another one. But you can't escape from this jail by force. So I'm stuck in a particular body, and I'm on a particular planet. I can't even go from one part of this planet to the other very easily. Even if I just want to get from here to Ireland, it's not so easy. I can't just swim. I mean, if I want to swim, I have to practice a long time to be able to swim. Or I have to get some kind of machine for which I have to earn money, or I have to make it or something. I can't just do whatever I want. Anybody here can do whatever they want? You know, when you're a child, you think, oh, when I grow up, I'll be able to do whatever I want. And then you grow up and you find out that you still can't do whatever you want. And someone thinks, well, if I just make enough money, then I'll be able to do whatever I want. But it doesn't matter. You still can't just do whatever you want. We're not free. We're bound in some, but it irritates us. Anybody like it? The Prabhupada said the soul actually needs freedom. That's our. It's just like our body needs air. He calls it a need of the soul. Without freedom, you can't have any love. So therefore, Krishna says, first you have to achieve freedom before you can achieve love of God. Of course, our way to achieve freedom is by meditating on Krishna. We don't try to achieve freedom outside of bhakti and then have bhakti for Krishna. But Brahma Bhuta Prasanatmana Sochati Nikansati Sama Sarveshu Bhuteshu Mad Bhaktim Labhate Puran. Real bhakti can start when you're free of the modes of material nature. Of course, how do you get free of the modes of material nature? Mamcha Yogya Vicharina Bhakti Yogina Sevate Sagunan Samatichai Cham Brahma Bhuyai Kalpate. How do you come to the Brahma Bhuta platform is by doing bhakti. So by doing practice bhakti, you can achieve the Brahma-Buddha platform, after which point you can do, you know, we could say, deep bhakti. Without freedom, how is it possible? Krishna is the ultimate, has the ultimate freedom in me, as parts of him also has freedom. We're very uncomfortable being in conditioned life. You can also think of freedom in terms of that there's no compulsion. You know, in conditioned life, I have to work. I have to do something to maintain my body. Krishna says no one can maintain their body without work. I'm not free to just, you know, do whatever I please. There's things pushing me to action. But my natural state is not like that. In my natural state, I'm doing things for Krishna only and solely because I want to, out of love, not because there's some kind of impetus like that. There's no force. So here we're all forced to do something, whether we like it or not. But in our natural state, it's not like that at all. Everything is spontaneous. And just coming from our own desire to demonstrate how much we love Krishna. We don't have any needs to meet. And only then can you really have an authentic loving relationship. I can't have an authentic loving relationship if I'm coming to somebody because I need something from them. then under the love is some sort of business deal. No matter how much I wish there wasn't. But in a state of freedom, I already have everything. I don't need anything. My relations with Krishna and with the other jivas are based simply on freedom and love. You love just because you want to love, not because you need anything. So that's the need of the soul, the aching, the hankering of the soul. Is that clear? It's a wonderful purport. Prabhupada said everything in bhakti is based on freedom. It's in the first canto. I don't remember the verse often. It's not hard to find. Anything else? We could take one more. I should remember where that is, but I don't know. Pretty sure it has to do with Narada. Yes?
Mataji, you mentioned earlier about how our actions create our thoughts, and our thoughts form our mind.
Yes.
So what does it look like when... What does our mind look like, or what shape does it take off?
Oh, that's easy. That's easy. Just like sometimes people see a ghost. What does the ghost look like? What does the ghost look like?
It's based on their activities, I guess.
What specifically?
What they did previously.
No, be very specific. So Mrs. Patel dies and becomes a ghost, and people see Mrs. Patel's ghost. What does Mrs. Patel's ghost look like? Mrs. Patel. The gross body we have fits on the subtle body. We form a subtle body of thoughts.
How does that change when it develops into a purified consciousness?
It says that Krishna consciousness dissolves the material subtle body. It awakens the real body. My analogy for this is if you bought one of those little paper packets of seeds that they sell in the shops, right? If you want to plant some veggies or something, flowers, right? They come in a little seed packet. Suppose you took that whole packet and you put it in a cup of water. What would happen? The packet would dissolve and the seeds would sprout. So when we think, because our mind is made, our material mind's a machine, just a machine. It's made up of our thoughts and our desires and our feelings, thinking, feeling, and willing. And when I say our actions produce our thoughts, it's really an integrated system between behaviors, thoughts, and emotions. So our thoughts contribute to our emotions and our behaviors. Our emotions contribute to our thoughts and our behaviors, and our behaviors contribute to our thoughts and emotions. They're very integrated. And bhakti tries to get at all of those. Do behaviors in relation to Krishna, have emotions in relation to Krishna, have thoughts in relation to Krishna. So the thinking, feeling, willing. So the material, subtle body is made up of material thoughts, material emotions, and material actions. If you no longer have any material thoughts, material emotions, and material actions, what's going to happen to that subtle body? It's not going to exist anymore. It's like it's built of building blocks of material thoughts. But you have to keep replenishing it. If you don't replenish, it'll dissolve. But that doesn't mean you become nothing. Because we have our own spiritual body with our own spiritual mind. So we're not saying think about nothing and become nothing. I mean, there are people who teach such things, but that's not what we're teaching. We're saying have spiritual thoughts, spiritual emotions, spiritual behavior. And those will awaken the spiritual body with the spiritual mind. Liberation means dissolution of the subtle body. As long as we have a material subtle body, we will take one body, one gross body after another, after another, after another, to fulfill the desires and the identity of that subtle body. The subtle body can only express itself through a gross body, which is why ghosts are very frustrated. So liberation means the subtle body dissolves. And Lord Kapiladev says the subtle body dissolves automatically in bhakti. Without any, you don't have to do some additional effort. You don't have to do something like the yogis do, where they meditate on merging the air with the air and the fire with the fire. You read about these kind of things in the Bhagavatam, I'm sure. But it just naturally awakens the real self, and the false self dissolves. Take one more question. Anybody else? No? So what do we have now?
Dora.